Welcome to Three and Out, your national NFL podcast featuring three sports media pros. Me, Ty Shelter from 538, joined by Samantha Bunton of NBC Sports and Michael Shoddy of the 33rd team. It's time for this week's big show where we go long on big NFL topics. We also have a big guest for you, like always, KC Joyner of the Athletic Fantasy, FF Diehards, PickWatch.com. He's also covered the NFL and Eagles for Philadelphia Inquirer, and he's got his own site, thefootballscientist.com, and paid subscription service for fantasy football analysis. We will talk to him. We will pick his brain. We will help get you a little bit of that advantage that he normally charges people for. Make sure you are subscribed to our free podcast. 3outpod.com has all of the feeds and links right there. Of course, you can also follow us on Twitter at 3outpod. Follow us on Instagram at 3outpod. Again, the website, 3outpod.com. Got a couple of things to get to. Terry McLaurin, Commanders wide receiver, signing a three-year extension worth up to $71 million in new money, according to Adam Schefter, puts him in the top five highest paid wide receivers. And that's it's 76.4% guaranteed, again, according to Schefter, which is according to the agent, which, you know, I'm sure once the paperwork is filed, a little bit of the edge will be taken off that. Again, it's the spring and summer of wide receivers. Samantha, what do you think of this deal?
Well, first of all, I think it's an interesting sort of marriage between making sure a player gets paid appropriately and fairly for what he can contribute on the field, and also not doing what Washington has frequently historically done, which is desperately overpay people in order to keep them there and then kind of screw themselves over on the back end of the contract. And this one's a little bit different. We don't have all the details yet, but the way that it looks right now is like, this is probably going to look like kind of a bargain, like a good deal for the team in a couple of years, barring some sort of catastrophe leading to injury or something like that. So I think this is great. And it's great news for Commanders fans. You've had a terrible offseason, unless you believe in Carson Wentz, and then everything that's gone on with Dan Snyder. And so this is like a little piece of positive news. I think potentially to be able to keep Terry McLaurin there and lock him up with an extension for a couple of years without kind of breaking the future bank to do it. Nice little bright spot for a franchise that has just really, really had a rough go of it this offseason.
What's most interesting to me about this deal is the fact that it's such a short-term deal that we're probably going back to the table in like 18
months.
This is a three-year extension, but it's probably not a three-year extension. It's probably 18 to 22 months from now. He gets slotted. Right now, he's like the fourth highest paid receiver in the NFL or something like that. We know Debo's going to leapfrog him. We know DK is going to leapfrog him. So he's going to still be in that, like, you know, nine-ish range when we sort of get to football. And that's going to keep dropping as more and more players get extended. You know, Hollywood Brown's in there. Then you've got that next crop of big wide receivers. And so when this hits, he's going to be back in sort of the middle of the pack of the top 25. And he typically has overperformed that. You know, do I think he's a top five receiver in football? No, but timing says he's got to get a top five contract right now. Timing will probably say in 18 to 22 months, he's going to get another top five contract. I talked to a bunch of, you know, the 33rd team's level of experts, and to a man, you know, Marty Morningwig, Mike Tannenbaum, Lavernius Coles all sort of said that was the most intriguing thing to them as well, because he's got a good couple of years here, not only to prove that he is the core of the Commanders offense, because I don't think anyone believes it's Carson Wentz. They just hope that Carson Wentz can sort of man that ship for a while. And Carson Wentz does have, you know, a big enough arm not to like lead this team to a Super Bowl by any means, but to get McLaurin like top five receiver money again in a couple of years, if he's his quarterback over that 2 to 3 year span, probably. Like, Carson Wentz has shown that before. He's also shown a lot of like stupid bad football things, but he's been able to get receivers production in the past, and he'll probably be able to do the same for McLaurin, who's arguably the best receiver he's had in a while. So this to me is keeping your best players around, maybe not at a budget, but like Samantha said, it's not breaking the bank for them either. It's not going out and paying through the nose for a Santana Moss type who was, you know, very talented, but they definitely overpaid him, you know, what, a decade ago. They definitely have overpaid players historically to bring them in. If you can keep guys that are homegrown and keep them on sort of a reasonable timetable, like they're keeping Terry McLaurin, I think that's better for overall team building. So when everything else in the world that could go wrong for the Commanders is going wrong for the Commanders right now, from the ownership on down, this is maybe one of the biggest bright spots.
Yeah, and Shadi, I'll agree with you about the short-term deal with the high guaranteed percentage. I think I said it when Kirk Cousins signed his, that 3-year fully guaranteed deal in Minnesota. This is the direction I want things to go. Make the contract real, right? Like, what is your commitment to this player? How much money are you going to give to this player? And then when is this player going to be free again? Just do that. Audie's style. Okay. This is a 7-year deal with X total value. And the last 2 years are voidable and half of it is in likely to be, you know, not likely to be earned incentives so that we can roll it back and get, you know, like none of the numbers mean anything. I have no idea how long this means my favorite player on my favorite team is going to still be on my favorite team. You know, like that's what we want to know. How much is this guy getting paid and how long is he going to be here? And I think this is the answer, right? Like, this is a 3-year deal. It is 3/4 guaranteed ish. And, you know, if he's going to stay for that third year or more, they'll probably have to go back and renegotiate, but you know, it's at least those 3 years, barring something weird, it's at least 2 years, right? So I like that things are going in a direction where at least you know where you stand with the player. We know where Joe Burrow stands on the issue of abortion and reproductive choice in the United States. He reshared an Instagram post that had been going around, saying, I'm not pro-abortion, I'm pro-Becky, who, there's a scenario, Susan, who, you know, was sexually assaulted, and kind of lists different scenarios in which someone who is pregnant might need to abort that pregnancy. And this is kind of one of a string of Joe Burrow coming out and saying like cool stuff off the field and stepping out in an era where, you know, outside of racial justice, you know, social justice from a racism lens, equality from an ethnic perspective, you don't see a lot of guys step out into these issues. Obviously we all are on this podcast where we all are, and anybody listening to knows that, but it's just interesting to me to see somebody come out and make this statement. Samantha, I want to know what your reaction was to this.
Well, I have kind of mixed feelings about this. On the surface, I'm ecstatic to see this because men are not doing their job on this issue. And that's why we are where we are, because men have not, even men who privately will say, yes, I support this, and who vote accordingly, do not speak out on this issue. And that's particularly true, I think, of, you know, male athletes. We just don't see it. Even the ones who are pretty good about speaking out about other things, other than the only one I can think of in the past is Chris Long, who has kind of done a good job about sort of speaking out on behalf of women. So from that perspective, I'm thrilled to see this. Joe Burrow has really, really done a good job of touching the stuff that nobody wants to touch and saying, I don't care. I'm going to come out and say it. However, there's a sort of deeply problematic element to the statement that he made, and it's sort of part of the reason that we have these stigmas that we do against abortion, because what he's doing is saying, don't worry, I'm not pro-abortion. And then he cites all of the very tragic and dramatic reasons that someone might need an abortion, the things that people believe will be more palatable to those who are on the fence about it, or who would look for exceptions to the law, when in fact abortion is healthcare and nobody has a right to occupy your womb against your will and tell you that you are a host rather than a person, and that they can decide whether or not you should be allowed to not have a child. You don't need to be in tragic circumstances to control your own body. So obviously this was not his intent, but it is a less brave way of coming out about it. And there's been a lot of talk amongst women about destigmatizing it and asking people to share their own personal stories, if they have one, about this kind of thing, saying, hey, I had an abortion, and I consider it healthcare and I don't regret it and my life is not in danger and I was not a rape victim and so on and so forth. So I wish he had included that too, but it's, you know, you don't want to come down on the only person in the entire NFL who was courageous enough to stand up and say something. So, and this is part of the problem too, that I think as women, we don't ask enough, you know, we fall down on our knees and say, thank you, man, for saying anything at all. But in reality, it's not enough. But then when they're the only person who does it, how do you criticize them? You know, I mean, it's whatever criticism I'm levying at Joe Burrow, and I love Joe Burrow for what he does, should be a thousandfold for all the other people who aren't brave enough to say a word, even if they agree with it. So I don't really mean this as a critique of Burrow. I appreciate very much what he did. I'm just kind of trying to call some attention to why we have the stigmas we do, because people seem to think that if they're going to put it out there and try to look out for women, that they have to present it in such a manner that it might be palatable to these apparently very delicate men who can't ever hear about this in a context where maybe somebody right. just doesn't want you telling them whether they're going to have a baby or not.
I'm going to echo just a ton of the things you said. And I love how careful you were in sort of critiquing the statement, which I think he just, to be clear, he just shared a meme. It wasn't like a personal statement. It was something that I saw going right. around. He shared it. I do think it's problematic. At the same time, I think it speaks to a larger issue of, on one hand, and again, I think you were very careful and did this very well, Samantha, like when there are advocates, when there are people who are willing to step up, I think those on the more liberal side of the aisle demand sort of some purity to these statements. And this was a problematic statement. I'm, you know, 100% agreeing with you there. But I'm glad to see like Joe Burrow being lauded, because he is one of the few who step out and say things that he thinks that aren't maybe as popular. And he's never going to say them correctly. Just like I'm going to say some things really incorrectly. Everyone's going to say some things incorrectly. And you can work with someone like Joe Burrow because you know he's open to that. And if you had that conversation right. with Joe Burrow, right. I 100% believe he would be like, oh man, I didn't even think about that. My bad, yo. And you can work with him. Whereas like on the other side of the aisle, like it's kind of, if I like this person, I don't care what they say. There's no demand for, you know, ideological purity. It's just rah, rah, siskumba, like let's go. Let's beat the other guys. And I do, like, as someone who's lived on Twitter online for so long, I've uh-huh. seen a lot of people, you know, try to speak up, and because they didn't say quite the right thing, get beaten down for good reasons. Like they didn't say the right thing, that they should be better informed, but they weren't. And I think, I do wonder if, because this is such a third rail subject, because it is something that men don't talk about with each other, let alone with women. And by and large, because so many men get this wrong, we're so often told, and for good reason, like, hey, you don't have a womb, shut up. Like it's hard for someone like Joe Burrow to just sort of come out and know what to say. And I think he saw this thing that resonated with him. He shared it. More power to him. Again, I 100% agree with you that it could have been better, but like also good job. Let's get better, but good job. Because that's probably where the bulk of people who aren't speaking up need to get. If they're not going to go right from not saying anything about any issue to all of a sudden being right on everything, they got to get to, I'm willing to stick my foot out on the ledge. And if you sort of break the ledge off underneath them, which I think everyone's, you know, to some extent is scared. If I say something, is it going to be the wrong thing? Am I going to get just as attacked from the side that agrees with me as the side that doesn't agree with me? And if you break the branches off underneath them, you know, maybe they never speak out again. And so again,
Shadi, did you just say cancel culture has gone too far?
That is 100% what I was saying. Damn cancel culture.
Oh, but poor men. Yes, my heart bleeds for you. Poor men who might get yelled at for saying the wrong thing while I have less rights than an M4. My heart bleeds for you. Let me get out my tiny violin.
But that, so
just finish your thought. Finish your thought.
Just,
yeah, yeah.
Just wrapping up here. I think we need more Joe Burrows. Every time he says something, yes. Every time I see yes. like a You know, Joe Burrow said this story on some website, like, I'm pleasantly surprised. He's not only just a random young white dude. He's a random young white dude, you know, with ties to the South and with ties to Southern Ohio, places that are typically not, you know, bastions of liberal thought. And so if we can have 30 more of him speaking imperfectly about things they care about, I will take that any day of the week.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. And, oh man, obviously there's, you know, without going completely off into the where's and why for's of this issue, it's something I wrote about on my newsletter, Give Me Shelter, a few months ago, about the need for guys to speak up, right? And to risk speaking up imperfectly, because the stakes are high, and it's just from a sports lens, I believe almost 500 different high level female athletes and coaches and agents and sports officials submitted amicus briefs to the Supreme Court going, look, like, this isn't just a nice thing for us. Like, if without reproductive choice, there's no such thing as elite women's sports. Like, it just doesn't happen. If you're telling us we can't control our bodies and when and how we start families, then we can't bet our livelihoods on playing sports. If we can't sit out 2 years and maybe not be as fast afterward, you know, like, this is part of it. And that's inclusion in every, that reflects back out into every aspect of society, which is what we always say when we talk about sticking to sports, because there is no sticking to sports, because sports is part of life and life is part of sports and sports reflects life and life reflects sports. And if you don't have anybody speaking out perfectly or you know, if everybody stays silent for fear of making a mistake, then nothing gets done and nothing gets protected. And the people who are speaking loudest on the issue are the only ones who are heard. And the people who are speaking loudest are the ones who want to take the rights away, and the ones who want to tell other people how to live, and the ones who want to stuff other people in boxes. And I've been trying to do my best on Twitter and online to speak up, you know, and be inclusive of trans and non-binary people in this. You know, I know trans parents, right? Like, it's not just a theoretical thought exercise for anybody, regardless of gender. Our society only works because we give people who can have kids the right to choose when and if they have kids. And that's, you know, NFL, you know, all the way to, you know, you don't have coaches working 100-hour jobs if they don't have spouses back home making sure that kids get fed and clothed and go to school, right? Like, and even then we see coaches' kids don't always come out the best, right? Because, like, oh, well, they have the luxury of having somebody else take care of their stuff for them. And now you see women advancing in the world of sports in every aspect, coaching, scouting, executive leadership. Like, the NFL needs women on and off the field to function at the level that it does. And I think more guys in the NFL need to speak out. And we need to applaud that. And we also need to educate them and help them and push them along and understand why and how everybody, not just people it directly impacts, needs these protections, because it ultimately directly impacts everybody. Normally, I would just go, you know, I'm the host, I'm the traffic cop, I go from segment to segment, and we need to talk to Casey Joyner, and we will in a second. But Samantha, I wanted to kick it back to you. Is there anything else that you wanted to say on this?
Yeah, I think that, to me, it's, well, first of all, it's important to note, I think that nobody is trying to cancel Joe Burrow by criticizing him.
No. No.
let's not do that. I think we're all grateful, but, you know, like I said, I think we've reached a point where, like, I don't necessarily feel obligated to be enormously grateful to men for speaking up and then kind of doing it incorrectly. Now, I think Shadi's absolutely right that, yes, we need more Joe Burrows. Yes, absolutely true. We need more cis white men who are willing to speak up about things that don't necessarily impact them personally and directly. And he's done this multiple times, and we love that about Joe Burrow. But he's the only person we've heard from. He didn't even really get it right in a way that I think matters deeply. And this idea that, oh, I don't want to say anything because somebody might yell at me. Well, guess what? Every time I say the word abortion, I get yelled at. by some conservative man who I've had people just for saying that I think this is a women's right to choose. I've had people tweet at my employer, which is ridiculous because, you know, it's a media company in New York. They don't care how I feel about this, you moron. But, you know, it's just every time I say it, I get yelled at. But I don't have a choice because it's me that's affected. So, like, maybe you could suck it up and understand that people are going to come at you. And also, women are never going to cancel you for saying it wrong if you're on the right side of it, ever. Nobody's ever going to do that. They're going to be nothing but grateful. But talking about it in terms of saying it better, it's, I mean, we've talked about this, I think, with trans rights as well. There are sort of sometimes things like you have to learn. It's a learning process. And if it doesn't apply to you personally, then you kind of have to be open to criticism from the people you're trying to help. It can't just be a, well, I was helping you. What more do you want? I don't want to get yelled at. Well, you know what? I don't have that luxury. And neither does any woman in this situation. And this is true. I think every time we have one of these issues where we ask somebody who is not part of the group being marginalized or otherwise sort of negatively impacted by something to ask for help from groups of people who are not part of that and who also have a lot more power, realistically. So that's kind of where I'm at on this. And certainly, like I said, I mean, we totally agree with you. We do need more Joe Burrows. But part of the way this gets fixed is if men become more receptive to the idea that, hey, if you didn't get this right, you have to do it again and you have to keep doing it. And you have to do it until you get it right. And you need to do it in greater numbers. So hoping to see that. I think we've seen some pretty good allyship within the NFL media community. I hope we see more from NFL players in the future for women.
Absolutely. All right. That said, we've got to get to Casey Joyner, our huge guest for this week. It is our midweek big show. Want to pick his brain about all the stuff that's going on in fantasy and DFS and gambling and just plain old regular football here on Three and Out, your national NFL podcast. Welcome back to Three and Out, your national NFL podcast featuring three sports media pros. It is our midweek big show. And of course, we have a big guest for you, Casey Joyner. You may know him from the Athletic Fantasy or FF Diehards, pickwatch.com, covering the Eagles and the NFL for the Philadelphia Inquirer, or of course, his own website, thefootballscientist.com. Casey, how are you doing today?
Doing fantastic. How are you guys?
We're good. We're good. And we're doing better than I think the Browns and Deshaun Watson are. And we have a fantasy, at least we hope. I'm curious about sort of the impact of this and other sort of long-term, let's say 6+ game player suspensions on fantasy value. I'm taking, I guess, the sort of ethics of what's going on with Watson out of it and just looking at it from a fantasy perspective, obviously not going to affect things like DFS, but if you're in, say, a dynasty league or any place where, you know, this is somebody you would be keeping on your roster long-term, I'm curious how this impacts his fantasy value, how it impacts you as a fantasy player. And I guess, what is your advice to people who are sort of somehow entangled with Deshaun Watson in a fantasy sense?
I feel bad for him because I always have this strategy. I wrote about it for in the article for The Athletic about drafting to the floor, meaning that when you're looking at a player, you should try and discern not what their ceiling is and go, boy, I hope that player's an RB1 or that guy's a wide receiver. You want to say, okay, where is their floor? What do you think their reasonable floor is? And draft them to that level. So if they're an RB, if they can be an RB2 on your roster, then you should draft them as an RB2 on your roster, rather than try and think they're going to be an RB1 if that's their ceiling. So using that in this situation, look at Deshaun Watson, and what's his floor? His floor for this year is zero. His floor for this year is nothing. You might not get a single point out of him. So that can be a disastrous thing. Having said that, I think for when it comes to dynasties, I wrote another article for The Athletic about dynasty, of what kind of value you can expect of a player long-term, because I did this whole long series for them about historical player values. And you'll find the players, you usually should be thinking in terms of 5-year windows for players. And a guy like Watson, maybe you can extend that window a bit. So keep him on your team, of course. But, I mean, if you've got a floor like this, you're going to have to get some insurance policies going for you this season, because I would anticipate if you have him on your roster that he's not going to score a point for you this year. If he does, great, his ceiling has moved up, but I think his floor is truly zero.
So we rolled right past mock draft season, and now it's mock fantasy draft season. And what are some of the general trends you're seeing for 2022 that are surprising you, are giving you hope, are, you know, sticking out to you as you see all of these different people setting up their leagues for the upcoming season?
One thing I'm not, I wrote an article for the Football Diaries magazines about running backs. The title of it is Running Backs Do Matter. And it's a play on the idea that there is this running backs don't matter philosophy, or that people can go with the zero running back philosophy. And zero running back philosophy came about around 10 years ago. And at that time when it came out, running back values were as low. They were historic lows. When you look at the number of 200-point running backs, that it dropped down to the lowest number it had ever been. And people started thinking, okay, I shouldn't value running backs as highly, and so they started drafting the positions, and rightfully so. Trends have now changed in the last 10 years, and teams are starting to run the ball more. In fact, I'll use the Kansas City Chiefs as an example. The Chiefs in their Super Bowl season, if you look at after Patrick Mahomes got hurt on that one sneak, I think it was against the Ravens, and he hurts his knee, the rest of the year, they were much more run-heavy than people remember them being. They were not a pass-centric team. They would still do it at times when they got behind in a playoff game. They say, hey, Patrick, you got to save us, and he throws a ton of passes and brings them back. But for the most part, they were a more run-centric team, and they won the Super Bowl. And they kind of got away from that the last couple of years. I haven't gotten back as much to it. And I think when you look at their offseason moves, they're going to be running the ball a lot more this year. And I think you're seeing a lot of teams doing that. So we add that to historical trend patterns for running backs comparative to the other positions. I think that running backs are still probably undervalued. And I think quarterbacks are extraordinarily – I see Josh Allen, and I understand Josh, why people would want to say, okay, I'm going to take Josh Allen. His ADP on Fantasy Pros right now is 22. I get it, why you'd want to consider taking him in the second round of the 12-team league. I get that. But two things. One, 11 quarterbacks scored 300 or more points last year, and that's the second year in a row where 11 quarterbacks scored 300 or more points. You don't need to stick your neck out for a quarterback, and Josh Allen has finished first in quarterback fantasy points in two straight years. This only the last quarterback to do it three straight years is Brett Favre. In fact, it's only happened for two quarterbacks since the AFL-NFL merger back in 1970. Only twice has a quarterback been the top scoring fantasy quarterback for three straight years. And I think when you look at what the Bills are doing with their team, they're going to try to be more run centric too. I think that they don't want to get into the shootout games like they're losing in the, you know, they lost that playoff game against Kansas City. So you add it all together, I think quarterbacks are overvalued right now in fantasy drafts, and I think running backs are still undervalued, even though trends say they ought to be more highly valued than they are.
Okay, well, Casey, let's look at the other position then. We had an off season with a wide receiver carousel spinning. You know, we had a lot of very talented players change teams, new situations, new quarterbacks. You know, of the big names that moved, your Davante Adamses, your Tyreek Hills. I guess which wide receiver are you most excited about their prospects for, and which do you think are losing a lot of face in terms of fantasy value or ADP?
If I had to pick one who I have a lot of faith in, and I have to caveat this, though, because I've got a lot of faith in him, but I'm still kind of iffy. It's A.J. Brown going to the Eagles Sirianni. Yeah. I cover the Eagles for I do some right-wing coverage on the Eagles for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they've got the best run-blocking coach in the league in Stoutland. Jeff Stoutland is the best run-blocking coach in the league. In fact, when the Eagles went to hire a head coach a couple years ago, the owner reportedly told candidates, if you want to hire on our team, you're going to have to keep Stoutland there. Are you comfortable with that? And the ones who weren't, they said, well, bye. That's how important he was. It was, we're not going to give you a head coaching job. We'll let you keep him. So they can run the ball exceptionally well. Nick Sirianni's a former wide receiver, and he started out last year wanting to throw, and then finally realized, hey, I can't do this. We need to run the football. That's who we are. Well, now he's got A.J. Brown and Devontae Smith, and I think they're going to want to funnel a portion, try and funnel more of their offense through the passing game to the extent that they can with Jalen Hurts at quarterback. But I think if they funnel enough through Brown, I think he'll be a more central part to their offense than he was to Tennessee, and he was pretty central to their offense. But I think he could be getting 140 targets in Philadelphia, 150 targets, and in a 17-game season, and I think that's going to drive his value up higher than he's ninth right now in ADP on Fantasy Pros. I think he could be a top five receiver.
Want to talk a little bit more about those offensive lines as you were talking about them with the Eagles. Let's expand that a little bit. You wrote a great article about basically ranking offensive lines in terms of what it means for fantasy play. And I think that's maybe one of the more underutilized things that people think about, because a lot of times I will see like, here's the rushing attack versus the other team's, you know, run defense. I don't see a lot, you know, things like, you know, factoring in yards before contact or offensive line efficiency when it comes to ranking running backs. Because if you've got, you know, whether you're going to handcuff some guys or whether you're going to, you know, stick your neck out for one of those guys, like you said earlier, where maybe I'm drafting a guy above his floor or projecting him a little bit, the offensive line comes into play in a big way. And I'm thinking that, you know, there's some teams out there like the Eagles, like the Lions, that have got some really good offensive lines and that could project to having some big running back numbers this season.
The article for the Athletic, I had some conversations with people, readers in the comment section. And some of them were like, well, these offensive lines, they don't necessarily agree with a couple of the grades. And I have to remind them that the grades for this article, they're done from a fantasy perspective. So I'm not looking at it. I'm looking at it, the offensive line metrics that I think will reflect fantasy performance versus other. And it's a subtle difference, but there are things that you – that you're trying to, like, I'm not worried about hurries for quarterback performance. I know it helps and things, but if I'm looking really at things, I want to frame more into sacks than I do hurries. I look at both of them, but I just put weights and things and say, okay, how's this going to affect fantasy performance? And when it comes to the running game, the NFL knows today the same thing that, I mean, you could track this back to Al Davis back in the 70s and things. Al Davis never invested heavily in his running backs because he realized that if you can block well, you can just get good running backs and they'll get great performance. Because the running game is all about blocking. So when you're reflecting it for fantasy teams, you mentioned the Eagles. They're the highest rated run blocking team, according to this article at The Athletic. The Chiefs are second, and the Eagles' run blocking grade was 100. It was all based on a 1 to 100 scale, with 100 being the best. The Chiefs are 100, or the Eagles are 100. The Chiefs are 97. The third best team is the Chargers at 73. That's how much better the Chiefs are, according to this, and how much better I project their run blocking to be than the rest of the league. And, of course, you can have injuries and things of that nature that will impact it. But going into the season, the Chiefs and the Eagles are easily the best run blocking teams in the league. And I think you have to reflect it when you're starting to look at, okay, do I want to draft Clyde Edwards-Helaire? Where am I going to rank him? And Ronald Jones, where are you going to rank him? I realize he doesn't pass block that well, but I don't think Edwards-Helaire is a guy who can carry. He's not a bell cow back. That's not what he can do. And you're talking a 17-game season. So I think Jones is probably going to have a lot more value than people are expecting him to have. So I think right now he'd be somebody I'd be targeting as an upside play, because you can draft his floor pretty late in drafts and get a pretty good ceiling out of it if he gets as many carries as the Chiefs are going to be able to give him.
Non-fantasy question for you. I want to talk Eagles offseason a little bit. The NFC East is obviously one of those divisions that's just sort of perpetually in the national news. The Commanders have really had a special offseason with trading for Carson Wentz and Dan Snyder landing himself in front of Congress and then apparently skipping the country. Giants are working through a very sort of public rebuild and retooling new regime, and the Cowboys are the Cowboys. But the Eagles have been relatively quiet outside of the trade for A.J. Brown. And I know you don't ever want to be in the news, ideally for negative reasons, but outside of just things that are sort of local interest, you know, mini camp and whatnot to local fans, how are you feeling about the Eagles offseason? Is it a good thing that they've been relatively quiet and kind of staying out of the news cycle while all these other things are going wrong with other teams in the division?
Howie Roseman takes all kinds of grief in Philadelphia for a variety of reasons because, well, that fan base is so – that's just who they are. They're very aggressive and very opinionated, and they tend Dick Vermeil said that the reason that the Eagles fail all the time is that the coaches were changing quarterbacks because the fans were screaming. He said, I'm not changing my quarterback. I'm going to keep Ron Jaworski in here. And that's kind of what you have to do. And I think Howie Roseman – weathers the storm because he says, I've got a plan and I know what I want to do with this team. And that's what makes me a little weird about A.J. Brown and fantasy, but just about the team in general, too, is that the Eagles say we've got a plan and they needed to upgrade the wide receiver core. And I totally get getting A.J. Brown. He is a big upgrade. And now they've got two really good receivers and now they can slot the rest of the receivers in and where they fit better with the offense. But I just get concerned that they're going to say, okay, we're going to pass the ball too frequently. Because, again, Jalen Hurts, remember, when they fell behind, when he was in Alabama, and they fell behind in that championship game, Nick Saban said, all right, well, I'm going to take Jalen out and put Tua in because Tua's a better passer. We look at Tua in the NFL and you go, well, Tua's not exactly a great passer, but if you bench Jalen Hurts for Tua's passing ability, it kind of says where Jalen might be from a passing perspective. So my concern about the Eagles is that they're going to have Sirianni is going to want to throw the ball more than he should, given what the structure that he has around him. But I think the Eagles – hopefully, internally, are finally realizing that you can continue to run the ball and win because they found that out last year. And if they stay in that route, which is, I think, what they're trying to do, that would explain why their offseason went like it did because they said, hey, we figured out who we were last year. Now this year we can go with that identity and stay with who we are and build upon that. And then we're not going to have to make any changes like some of the other teams need to make changes because they have other factors that are making them change.
Casey, I'm an old school season-long fantasy football guy. And, when there was the advent of DFS, a lot of people kind of, I don't want to say jumped ship, but, there's a lot of buzz around DFS and I got into it a little bit. I'm like, this is way more like gambling than fantasy in my mind. And like the approaches and strategies and like arbitrage and this really felt more like gambling than fantasy to me. What I knew is fantasy. Now we've, there's all this money flowing into actual gambling. And I'm just curious, still doing, traditional fantasy analysis. Are some people kind of, is the buzz kind of coming back? Are people coming back? Are you seeing, if you got the footballscientist.com and you're selling your information and your strategical and tactical advantages. So like, how are you seeing audiences react to this for traditional fantasy versus DFS and then gambling?
I've been doing gambling content for the Inquirer last year. I had an article series that covered fantasy DFS and gambling, and still I think gamblers are an entirely different world, and I think they tend to I don't think there's as much bleed over between gambling and fantasy as is generally thought. And when it comes to DFS is, if people have learned this, that it's this way in some way in gambling too. There's whales, there's sharks, and there's minnows, and you don't, and frankly, right, unless right. You've got a really good system, you're going to be a whale. And I think that when it comes to DFS, I think that as fantasy managers floated into DFS, they realized that was the case, and they came back to fantasy football. There's a social element in fantasy football that you're just not going to get in any kind of sports. So I think that bullish on the future of fantasy. Standard old school fantasy as opposed to what you'd find in DFS. I think that there's going to be some value there, but I think the two audiences are more distinct than a lot of people think.
All right, cool. So you've got a lot of places where people can follow your work, but where do you want to highlight, make sure that our listeners are following what you're doing and your best stuff?
Well, three places right now. Real quick, you can get at my material will be available. First up, it's thefootballscientist.com. That's where I sell my pay dirt. Subscription service where you can find my draft guide and my start sit service, and I do weekly chats and I send out newsletters. That's available at thefootballscientist.com. You can also find my material on newsstands in the Football Diehards magazines and the Athletic Fantasy Football magazine will be all available later this month. And I also do weekly fantasy content at the Athletic in season, and I'll be doing some content for the Philadelphia Inquirer this season and maybe other places too, but that's about where I'm at the moment.
All right, sweet. Casey Joyner, all those great places. And what's your Twitter handle?
Twitter handle is the initials KC Joyner and the JOYNERTFS. So Casey Joyner TFS for the Football Scientist.
Gotcha. Follow him on Twitter and stay with us. We've got more big topics to get to when we come back right here on 3 and Out, your national football podcast. We are back here on 3 and Out, your national NFL podcast. Great stuff from KC Joyner, of course. And I think we hit on what we talked about. Let's rip up the script. It's the season of wide receivers. It's the summer of wide receivers, spring of wide receivers. Shadi, you brought it up. We were talking with KC. You have the AJ Brown. We've got the big deals coming. We've got DK Metcalf yet coming. There's lots more deals to come. How do you think this is going to change the landscape? And who do you think is really going to be the one that sets the bar?
Yeah. So I wanted to take something KC said and then sort of extrapolate it and maybe connect it to the Terry McLaurin thing we said earlier, because this is the summer of wide receivers. You know, I've got the old timey music, you know, there's a season for everything. Turn. This is where we're at. And the receivers are changing the landscape of the game in such a big way. And there was actually another quote, you know, if you take KC's quote about AJ Brown during our interview, and then Allen Robinson came out and said that, you know, the way that, you know, teams don't know how me and Cooper Kupp are going to fit in together, and that's a positive, you know, we understand we're going to be, you know, firing all cylinders, and, you know, the rest of the league doesn't get it. The rest of the league doesn't understand it. And there's a lot of that going around. I think Davante Adams could probably say the same thing. I think Hollywood Brown could probably say the same thing. All these guys who have shuffled around, moved around. And then you've got guys like Deebo Samuel who have done that already, who've already carried their teams and now are trying to get paid for it. And Lavernius Coles told me that if he was Deebo Samuel, he'd be on his phone right now because he knows that he's worth more than Terry McLaurin. So, like, take your pick, guys. Take your pick. Call your shot. Like, what is the new receiver scenario? Whether it's an old face in the same place who's getting paid and the offense is going to, you know, revolve around him, or it's a guy who switched position. What is the new sort of world of wide receivers? Which corner of that world are you most excited about?
So I almost wonder if, like, the new scenario is there is no scenario, because it's going to be different in almost every instance because the position has kind of diversified in that way. And we talk about Deebo and how he's kind of playing this very unique role, and it doesn't really align with what anyone else is doing anywhere else, as he has sort of pointed out in regard to what he's doing, and then maybe he's not entirely happy about it. And then you've got these guys at the other end of the spectrum, like, you know, Shadi, you mentioned the Allen Robinson quote where, you know, they were kind of like, oh yeah, you know, I'm not worried. And you wonder, you know, sometimes this is a sort of defensively answered question to, you know, are you upset that you're not the number one receiver in town? And these guys are like, no, the things we're going to do together are going to be magical. I don't care if I'm the only show in town. But we also still have guys floating around out there who've made it very, very clear that they are in fact the only show in town, and that anybody else around them is supplemental. And if they're not, they will ask to be traded. So we've got this sort of, how dare you criticize my teamwork on one end of it. And then at the other end, there's, you know, the Odell Beckhams of the world that, you know, like, I'm sort of front and center. But, you know, even he, interestingly, kind of changed his tune when he went to a different situation. So it seems to me that, like, there's a lot more going on here than just, well, I'm this type of receiver and I want this kind of thing. It's sort of, well, you know, if you are happy in your situation, then you're willing to do. And I wonder about this with Deebo as well, which is, does the role you're playing matter less than how you feel, whether you're appreciated, whether you're being paid fairly for that, that sort of thing? Does that change from spot to spot? So a guy like Allen Robinson and what he's saying here, it sounds to me like he's buying in. And that, again, I think is sort of lending some credibility to coaches who can kind of get guys to buy into the whole mindset and here's what we're doing here, and do you believe in what we're doing here? Very, very different, again, if you come back to Odell and look at how he felt about Cleveland versus how he felt about the Rams. And there's a good argument that says Odell was right about that when you look at how those two organizations have been run, that it wasn't really about Baker Mayfield or Odell needs to be the only person getting the ball or whatever, and whether you agree with how he handled it or not. Like, it's different, and maybe in a good way. So that's sort of what I take away from all this. It's just that we have some pretty interesting sort of diversity in the role that wide receivers are going to play and how teams are going to kind of scheme these things up and kind of sell themselves to these guys in a way that in the past, it was more about players selling themselves to the team.
I love the way you put that, Samantha, because that's what you know, when you think about like the old school, like number one wide receiver, number two wide receiver, number three wide receiver, and like, you know, we used to think of that as like first string, second thing, string, third string, right? And then with the Bill Walsh / West Coast offense, you know, that the X, Y, and Z roles were a little bit more particularized and specialized. And now it's like both way more specialized and way more wide open, right? Where you have receivers who do what they do, and then you build the offense around what they do. And that doesn't really fit into like a top dog type pecking order. If you get on the list of just receptions. Like, who had the most receptions last year? There's like seven guys who aren't wide receivers, you know, running backs and tight ends. You also have players who didn't start. Mark Andrews, Hunter Renfro technically started 9 games for the Raiders and had 103 catches, right? Like, it's unbelievably productive season. And that's an unbelievably like huge part of your offense, but he's not on the field for the first play of every game. Amon-Ra St. Brown, Cole Beasley, like, you go down this list and it's like, okay, some of these players have really specialized roles and the value is what they're doing on the field and not necessarily the biggest number at the end of it, or, you know, starting every game and playing every down or whatever. And, you know, obviously the elite of the elite, the top, that your Cooper Kupps and your Davante Adams and your Tyreek Hills, and like, these players are going to be on the field as often as they can be on the field, and they're always going to be dangerous and they're always going to be the focal point of their offense. But some of these next tier guys and some of the ones that are coming up into it, like Debo, like DK Metcalf, you know, it's like, are we seeing a lot of DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett, like, rivalry? You know, no, like, they have their own roles in the offense, their own roles in the team, their own roles in the league. And as wide receiver, you know, if we're going to get 6 great, 7 great, 8 great wide receiver prospects going in the first or high second rounds every year, and teams are going to continue to integrate them, you know, I think it's just the way this position has diversified and the way it's being used differently, I think it just kind of changes everything about the way we evaluate and pay them.
Yeah, I'm right there with you guys. And I love even just how sort of historically, you know, we went from having, you had to have like a Brady or Manning to be legitimate, you know, and whoever was sort of next on that list, you could be sort of kind of legitimate, but you knew your offense was not going to be what you wanted it to be unless you had a dude of that caliber. And it was constantly trying to find the next guy like that. Sorry, John Elway, you never did it. Now it's almost like, because of the advent, you know, it was almost like you could pick, like, do we invest in a third receiver? Do we invest in the running back position? And for a while, I think we were in that middle ground where it was almost like that was the swap. But now it's almost like, can we pay someone number one receiver money and roll with Carson Wentz or roll with Jared Goff? Or, you know, I think this isn't a perfect comparison, but David Carr, who's been good, bordering on very good, but is not great. If we give him Davante Adams, can that be what makes the jump? If we have a Debo Samuel, if we pay a Debo Samuel, can we roll with a very unproven, you know, essentially first year quarterback in Trey Lance? You know, I get that he's a second year, but he hasn't played yet. So it's almost like historically we've moved from, you needed that number one guy no matter what, to now it's like, there's less of a variance, almost like fantasy, almost like what Casey talked about before. If every quarterback is putting up God mode numbers, is the differentiator having that first or second quarterback, or can you live with like the sixth quarterback? As long as you also have like that top receiver, that receiver who is that Tyreek Hill. I think Tyreek Hill is a really good example of, we know Tua's flawed. The Dolphins have shown time and time again that they know Tua's flawed, but rather than replace Tua, which we would have done like a generation ago, knowing your quarterback is flawed means you replace that quarterback. Now it's, yeah, but you know, even if he's only like the 10th best quarterback next year, we've got Tyreek Hill. We probably make the playoffs that way, which is a legitimate thought right now and would have been absolutely unthought of. You never would have gone out and gotten like, you know, Chris Henry, the wide receiver, or, you know, whoever, pick your, you know, mid to upper tier wide receiver of the late 90s or early 2000s. You never would have gone out and gotten that guy and been like, okay, that's what's going to make Chad Henne, you know, a playoff winning quarterback. No one would have done that. You would have just simply written off Chad Henne and, you know, said goodbye.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And maybe to Casey's point, you know, if you go get AJ Brown and add him to Devontae Smith, you can make Jalen Hurts good enough to get by. Unfortunately, just adding AJ Brown and Julio Jones wasn't enough for Ryan Tannehill, but we shall see. And we shall see. You subscribe, rate, review, share, give us 5 stars on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. Give us 5 stars on Spotify. I'd love to see it. If you liked what we did, if you liked our episode, if you liked what Casey Joyner brought to you. Again, normally he charges at Payder for fantasy advice. You got to pick his braid a little bit right here on Three and Out. And of course, again, make sure you're tuned in Monday. We do key takeaways, usually live on Twitter Spaces. Make sure you're following us on Twitter at Three Out Pod, and you will know when that is happening. And jump on and join us there. Make sure you follow us on Instagram at 3OutPod. Make sure you're subscribed at 3OutPod.com, wherever you get your podcast, whatever feed or service you use. We see you guys listening. You guys loved the Mina Kimes episode last week. I hope you loved this one too. Make sure you share it and tell your friends, because we love doing it. Want to keep doing it for you right here on 3 and Out, your national NFL podcast.